to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, former ambassador to Guatemala and Peru, John Hamilton speaks on what embassies do in a crisis, the collapse of the Fujimori regime in Peru. John Hamilton was the U.S. ambassador to Peru from 1999 to 2002 and to Guatemala from 2002 to 2005. A career officer in the United States Foreign Service for 35 years, he served in Greece, Costa Rica, Spain, Peru, Mexico, and Guatemala. Before being named ambassador to Peru, he was the second-ranking official in the Western Hemisphere Affairs Bureau of the State Department and had responsibility, among other issues, for U.S. policy toward Cuba. He also worked for extended periods on Central American affairs and was recognized for his support of peace negotiations that ended the 36-year armed conflict in Guatemala in 1996. He has received the Department of State's Superior Honor Award four times. On Friday, February 13th, he spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on what embassies do in a crisis, the collapse of the Fujimori regime in Peru. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents the former ambassador to Guatemala and Peru, Mr. John Hamilton.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be back in Anchorage. As Ted said, I spent 35 years in the Foreign Service. I come from a family of five in North Carolina, and it was always a struggle over the course of my career to convince one brother in particular that I worked for the State Department and not for the CIA, because he would always ask me, well, what do you actually do? And I had a tendency to answer that question in abstract terms. Well, we manage our relationships with other governments. We work these kinds of issues. And he would go, uh-huh. So after I retired, I wrote an article from which my presentation this morning is abbreviated, and it was published, and you can find it at the website of the Fletcher School, the Fletcher Journal of World Affairs, to describe what an embassy is doing. And I think you can safely assume any time you pick up the paper and read about an ongoing crisis in a developing country in particular, that the U.S. Embassy is sort of similarly engaged as we were in Peru at the time that the Fujimori government was failing. So I sent this article to my brother, and he read it, and he called back, and he said, interesting. Why didn't you say so before? So I'll tell the story. It requires some scene setting. You may know that in November 2000, after trying unsuccessfully to contain a crisis of political corruption, President Alberto Fujimori of Peru faxed in a letter of resignation from Japan, where he was visiting. Several days later, the Peruvian Congress voted to refuse to accept his resignation and to remove him from office, a kind of you can't quit, you're fired transaction. A transition government came into office for 8 months, held new elections, and a new government took office. So this was, the faxed-in resignation was a way, a pathetic ending to a government that in some ways had rendered real service to Peru. Fujimori took over when there was 3,000% inflation and a shrinking economy and free fall. In Peru, he stabilized the economy and got inflation under control. He defeated not one but two guerrilla terrorist insurgencies. He resolved long-standing, often violent border conflicts with Chile and Ecuador. The one with Ecuador in particular required uncommon statesmanship and political courage, and he deserves a lot of credit for that. At the same time, Fujimori was no small D Democrat. He was very authoritarian, and he had effectively eviscerated Peru's democratic institutions. He had control of the legislature, the judiciary, and the elections commission. He controlled much of the print media, the tabloid press in particular, which he used to attack political opponents, and a good deal of the broadcast media, TV in particular, was under his control. He had also overcome a constitutional prohibition on a third term through means that were legally and politically questionable. And he won a third five-year term in May 2008 in elections that international observers had judged not to have met minimum conditions of fairness. He took the oath of office in July 2000 amid violent demonstrations in downtown Lima and with a smell of tear gas inside the congressional chamber where the ceremony took place. Now, the U.S. government had tried unsuccessfully right after the elections to get a condemnation of them with the aim to forcing new elections from the Organization of American States. We had failed in that, but we did get a resolution that created a so-called a National Dialogue for Political Reform under OAS auspices. And so this began in August and was ongoing at the time that the sort of final crisis that I'm going to describe began. Now, also, and following the election, the government had engineered the defection from the political opposition of enough members of Congress to give it a much more comfortable majority, working majority in the Congress. This gave it a measure of comfort on two issues. One, enabled it to prevent an effort to get a national referendum calling for new elections, and two, it protected him from the exercise of an article of the Constitution in Peru, unlike almost any Latin American constitution I ever saw. It permitted the president to be removed by a simple majority vote in Congress on grounds of his physical or moral incapacity. One more bit of background information, and then I'll get on with the story. Fujimori was heavily dependent upon a man named Vladimiro Montesinos. Montesinos was his intelligence operative and political advisor and political operative. He was not the titular but the de facto head of Peruvian intelligence, an outfit known by its Spanish acronym SIN. That has connotations in English that are not inappropriate, but it was that's pronounced the scene in Spanish. Montesinos was a shadowy figure, rarely seen in public. Many people thought, and possibly many people do still think, he was a CIA agent. That actually was not true. And in fact, our relationship was distinctly uneasy. Our dealings with him were primarily on narcotics cooperation and intelligence matters. And considering that he was the second most important person in government, our contacts with him were as sparing as we could make them. Now, 4 years before I got to Peru, the Clinton administration took up the issue, should we refuse to have anything to do with Montesinos altogether, but had decided against it. But as the extent to which the extent to which Montesinos had been responsible for many of the dirty tricks and other flaws of the 2000 elections became clear, Washington took up this issue again. And in September 2000, on the margins of the UN General Assembly, Secretary of State Albright and accompanied by National Security Affairs Director Sandy Berger met with Fujimori and conveyed to him our view that he really ought to move Fujimori out of government. Thus, by the time the crisis began, less than a week later, we had conveyed for the first time an anti-Montesinos message to the Peruvian president, but we had not at that point made an equivalent public statement, nor had we had any instruction to end our ties with him in the embassy. So, on September 14th, a Thursday, a man named Fernando Olivero, the head of a small opposition party in the Congress, released to the media a videotape which showed Montesinos Payne, a congressman who'd been newly elected in the spring elections, $15,000 U.S. currency, to join government ranks. Olivero did not reveal how he had gotten the tape. If he had more, he certainly implied that he had lots more where that one came from. Our intelligence people were able to tell me immediately, the tape's authentic. We've been in the room where the scene was taped. For the next several days, Peruvian TV ran this 56-minute video. These became, by the way, known as Vladi videos. Montesinos' first name was Vladimir Vladimiro from Vladimir Lenin, and his parents were communist. And so Vladi from Vladimiro and Videos, so they were known as Vladi Videos. If you Google Vladi Videos, you'll get about 100,000 responses. So this 56-minute transaction was shown over and over and over again on Peruvian TV. Peruvians were fascinated. The effect was electric. It had been one thing for them to sort of say, oh, when these guys joined the government and they bribed them, they bought them off. So it was one thing to know that sort of, or believe it in the abstract. It was another thing to see the whole sordid exchange carried out on TV. It was both laughable and stomach-turning at the same time. Now, we immediately, as soon as we heard this, conveyed the news to Washington, and we recommended seizing this opportunity to break with Montesinos publicly, which, as I said, was something that we hadn't done up to that point. The Department of State did that from the press spokesman's daily news conference the next day, and our position was widely conveyed in the Peruvian media. 2 days later, on Saturday night, September the 16th, President Fujimori shocked everybody, the Peruvian nation. He went on national TV with a surprise announcement. He said he was calling for new elections to be held within a year, that he would not be a candidate, and that he was, quote-unquote, deactivating the SEAN, the intelligence service. Now, no one had, in their wildest imagination, imagined this. To the contrary, we had pretty much assumed that the Fujimori government would seek to ride this storm out, to brazen their way past this embarrassing revelation. So the fact that he had done the complete opposite led us to scurrying to contact everybody in government that we could to see if we could get the story of how this decision had come about. What we pieced together over the next several days was that Fujimori had tried and failed to simply fire Montesinos, and that this Samson-like destruction of his own government was the only way that he could actually get Montesinos out of government. Montesinos reportedly was holed up in his intelligence office, refusing to leave. Now, the next morning, I consulted by secure phone with Washington on next steps. We all saw Fujimori's decision as resetting the button on democratic development in Peru and giving us a tremendous opportunity. The problem of Fujimori's lack of legitimacy in his third term would be gone with new elections and a new government. Montesinos would be out, and the hands-dirtying relationship that we had had with him would be ended. New elections could be free and fair. So it was a great example of the old adage that crisis brings opportunity. I worked the phones in Lima all day, conveying U.S. support for Fujimori's announcement to senior Peruvian civilian and particularly to military officials. Everybody I talked to professed a support for his decision. Later that day, however, a Peruvian intelligence officer called his counterpart in the embassy to say, hey, it's going to be business as usual tomorrow over at the scene. Come on over. We'll put our feet up on the desk and have a cup of coffee. And he spoke went on to speak rather dismissively of the decision the president had announced to deactivate his service. This was a lower-level official, not Montesinos. But we took this as a probe to see if there was going to be any difference between the CIA and State Department on this issue. And we pushed back hard. I had the intelligence official call back and say, hey, you don't understand. We are suspending our contacts with you. It's over until Montesinos is gone, and whatever the government is going to do to reconstitute an intelligence force has been accomplished. And we also conveyed to other officials in the government this first indication that the intelligence service wasn't going along with what the president had announced. So we reiterated, in particular, our support for Fujimori's decision to move Montesinos out of government. Now, for the next several days, there was confusion, a lot of uncertainty as to what, if anything, was happening to move events forward. The government, when we would ask, gave us rather Delphic assurances that the Montesinos question was evolving favorably, whatever that meant. And they said that there was no resistance from within the government or military to what Fujimori had announced. Now, that posture changed very abruptly on midday Wednesday the 20th. Unfortunately, right after I had finished giving a briefing to the U.S. press on background, in which I was conveying pretty much our assessment that there didn't seem to be any threat of a coup. The vice president, Francisco Tudela, phoned me on Fujimori's direction to say that, in fact, the military was giving Montesinos support and the government needed our help to get him out. That afternoon, the government postponed its regularly scheduled meeting on the OAS dialogue that I mentioned on a pretext, and the real reason they told me was to free themselves up to deal with this Montesinos question. By this time, I'd gotten some written instructions from Washington to convey our support directly to Fujimori, and I met with him late that night. Prior to the meeting, I made a round of phone calls to every senior Peruvian military officer that I could get hold of to sort of take the pulse. Most professed support for Fujimori, but one, the defense minister, a uniformed military officer, said clearly that they did not want Montesinos abandoned and that they were not yet ready to state publicly their support for the decision. That night, Fujimori told me that the situation was delicate and complicated, the words he used. These, in my experience, when a Latin American says something is complicado, it's a euphemism for meaning it's a hell of a mess. And he said he could not exclude the possibility of a coup. There was a kind of gallows humor that he used on that occasion. I carried out my instructions, and I additionally explained how I thought we could possibly be of assistance, perhaps by having senior U.S. military officials call their counterparts to weigh in on his behalf. Fuji said, well, my senior civilian officials are right now huddled over at the Defense Ministry with the top military. So let's let the situation mature overnight and take stock of things in the morning. But 3 hours later, I got a call. This is now 1 a.m. from the foreign minister, who says, good news, Fujimori has agreed to leave Peru, leave government, leave Peru, and go to Brazil. The Brazilians, of course, have to agree to take him. Would you have Washington call the Brazilian government and back our request for this? Now, the Brazilians had actually had closer relations with Fujimori than we had, but we judged that the possibilities at that point of having Fujimori arrested and tried in Peru were slim to none. Montesinos had been the agent by which control of the judiciary had been obtained. And we just didn't think anything other than just getting him out of government, getting him out of the country was achievable in the short term. So Washington agreed to do this, but the Brazilians refused. Later that day, the foreign minister was back in touch and said, all right, he's agreed to go to Panama. We should talk to the Panamanians. Already getting tired of phone calls from Lima, Washington reluctantly agreed. They did talk to senior people in the Panamanian government, and the president of Panama agreed to do this. I got the green light. I put the Panamanians and Peruvian officials in touch to work out the logistics, and it appeared that he would leave that night, a Friday the 22nd. But when the Panamanians found out that Montesinos wanted to arrive in Panama with no less than a dozen armed security agents, they balked and said, hey, wait a minute, we didn't buy into this. So the deal was off. The Peruvians pleaded with us the next day, Saturday, to press the Panamanians harder, but Washington had had enough of this and refused. The Peruvians then turned to the head of the OAS, the former Colombian president, Cesar Gaviria, and to the presidents of Brazil and to Chile, and they all three got involved and turned the Panamanians around. And so that night, Montesinos flew out on a small plane with a reduced number of security agents, and his departure from Peru was headlines in all of the newspapers the next day. The respite from crisis was brief. On Monday at midday, the foreign minister was back in touch. His opening words, will this nightmare never end? Montesinos had just phoned him in the middle of an OAS meeting on his cell phone, upset that the Panamanians had not granted him a permanent asylum, as he had understood they would, and upset that two Peruvian legislators were already in Panama trying to find out where he was holed up. He claimed that his life was in danger and he was threatening to come back to Peru where he thought he would be safer. The foreign minister pleaded for us to go back to the Panamanians and urge them to give him full asylum. Washington, with great reluctance, by this time they're really dreading my phone calls, did engage the Panamanians again. They came up with the very useful suggestion, just give him asylum for 1 year. By that time, there'll be a new government. We can examine again the question of what to do with Montesinos. Maybe there'll be, by then, possibility of trying him in Peru. But the Panamanians wanted to bargain with us to see if they could get help on unrelated issues where, frankly, we had no give in our position, and so we'd made no progress. Now, as these events were playing out, the government and the OAS dialogue group struggled to find a mechanism, a constitutional mechanism, for actually calling and holding new elections. The problem was that Peru has a presidential system like ours. It's not parliamentary where you can call new elections at any time. So there was no constitutional way of doing what Fujimori had announced and what everybody devoutly wished to do. Eventually, the government came up with an ingenious solution that calls to mind the Latin America's literary genre of magical realism. The government proposed amending the Constitution on a one-time basis to permit new elections. The problem with that approach was that the constitutional mechanism for amending the Constitution is to have a vote on the amendment by two successive sessions of the Congress. And the session was coterminous with the period for which they served. So that meant that you couldn't get to new elections without holding new elections. And so they were caught in this catch-22 situation. The solution to this was that the government simply said, hey, it's not written anywhere actually what defines a legislative session. So by presidential decree, we're saying that a legislative session is going to end when we put the gavel down at the end of October, and we will bring the Congress back into session on the beginning of November. We'll have two votes, one on October 30th, the other one on November 1st, and the Constitution will be amended and we'll have new elections. That's what they did, and everybody was happy. The constitutional veneer on this solution was thin indeed, but this was what everybody wanted to do, and we certainly weren't going to voice any opposition to it. Now, once Montesinos was out of the country, the opposition, Democratic opposition, turned its full attention to Fujimori, demanding his resignation. Now, our policy until then had been pretty much in sync, really in lockstep with the position of the Democratic opposition, although some of them had criticized our role in enabling Montesinos' departure. But we thought it would be a big mistake for Fujimori to step down until the question of the relationship with Montesinos was definitively resolved. And we explained this to key members of the Peruvian opposition, but their mistrust of Fujimori trumped any tendency they had to trust us on this. So we were beginning to get a little bit out of sync in our policy with the Peruvian opposition. Now, on October the 12th, the opposition united in the Congress to attempt a vote of censure on the congressional directorate. Four Fujimori loyalists, all women, who ran that Congress with iron fist. The Fujimori forces prevailed by a margin of four votes, but we learned through contacts in the Congress that five congressmen that we knew to be just totally in the control of Fujimori had voted with the government and thus had kept, provided the margin of difference to keep his position secure. As once the opposition got control of the Congress, they could invoke this article of the Constitution I mentioned at the outset and simply vote Fujimori out of office. Now, a week later, matters took a serious turn. I came out of a play where I'd had my cell phone turned off on a Sunday afternoon. And in the space of 45 minutes, my deputy chief of mission had phoned, had left five emails. Call me, call me, call me. And when I did, she said, our embassy in Panama has been in touch. The Panamanians have just told them that Montesinos is on his way back. He's in a small plane. They even gave us the tail number. Wasn't that nice of them? And I said, do the Peruvians know? And she said, you know, I don't know. I wanted to talk to you before I did anything. So I said, okay, you call Washington. I'll call the Peruvians. And I called the Peruvians, and they were aghast, disbelieving. I spoke to the foreign minister. And only that morning, he said, the Panamanians had told him that they were on the verge, that they were this close to giving Montesinos asylum. That Montesinos was now on his way back, I was telling him, was hard for him to process. And as I hung up, it occurred to me, oh my gosh, he suspects us of playing some sort of double game here. That night, when my phone calls to him and other senior officials started going unanswered, I concluded they heard about it from us first. It went against what the Panamanians had been telling them. They think we're being duplicitous. I did get hold, finally, of Fujimori himself, and it took about a half hour, but I persuaded him that we weren't doing any such thing, that we were taken as much by surprise as he. And I said, you know, we could still make an effort, because his plane has to refuel in Guayaquil, to have him detained there on whatever grounds, immigration grounds maybe, while you figure out what to do. And so a senior official from Washington called the Ecuadorians, asked them to do that. They said, well, the Peruvians hadn't made a request. I went back to Fujimori, told him that the Ecuadorians quite reasonably wanted to hear it from them. So Fujimori puts in a call to the Ecuadorian president, who refuses to take his phone call. Fujimori is back in touch with that news. By this time, we've learned Montesinos' plane is on the ground in Guayaquil. So I said, you've got to appeal to Montesinos himself, not to come back. And we had an official from our consulate run out to the airport, hand Montesinos a cell phone. I gave the number to Fujimori, and Fujimori and Montesinos spoke. Fujimori called me later, said he refused, he's on his way back. At 5 a.m., after a couple hours sleep, I was back in touch, learned that his plane had flown past Lima to an Air Force base 2 hours south. He had gotten off the plane and had promptly disappeared with a few aides and with a convoy of armed vehicles that he had gotten from the military. Later that morning, I spoke to Fujimori by phone. We were both exhausted. Neither one of us had any bright ideas. My advice was to go ahead and issue a public warrant for his arrest, and he was reluctant to go that route. Later that day, my staff rushed in and said, turn on your TV. We did, and Peruvian television was following a massive police military manhunt that Fujimori was personally conducting all over the city to find Montesinos. And this was ridiculed in the Peruvian U.S. international press as kind of Keystone Cops. And frankly, the Peruvian opposition wasn't buying this break between the two as being genuine. Over the... it was about this time that Fujimori had Montesinos' personal residence searched, obviously looking for the archive of Vladivideos. And 7 years later, it was to be this illegal search that he would be tried and convicted for and sentenced to 6 years in prison. That skips ahead, but I assume you pretty much know the end of the story anyway. Now, it was also during the same time frame that the breakthrough on elections that I described above took place. And in addition to resolving the constitutional difficulty, the government agreed to change the leadership of the Elections Commission, and they agreed to other changes that would pretty much ensure that the elections would be free and fair. In return, they asked only for a new amnesty law that would protect people that had served in the Fujimori government from what they thought would be political persecution. The opposition refused. This looked at time for time like it was going to block new elections, but eventually the government gave way on this. There was no amnesty, and they went ahead with elections. Now, at this point, with Montesinos at least in hiding, we didn't know where, and with the way to elections having been made fairly been cleared, I thought it was more than likely that Fujimori would last in office until the elections were held. But a week later, in early November, the Swiss government revealed that Montesinos had stashed $48 million away in a Zurich bank. And so this led people to conclude that Fujimori has probably stolen money too. And it added a powerful new dimension to public attitudes toward him and his government. Now, it's one thing to abuse the political process, but when you steal our money, that really makes us angry. I described Fujimori's position to Washington as completely or increasingly precarious. And on November the 13th, there was another vote in the Congress to remove the congressional leadership. This time, the Montesinos deputies switched, voted against Fujimori. The leadership was out. They elected a new leadership of opposition figures. And so at this moment, Fujimori's fate was in the hands of the opposition, and his exit from government would be done and achieved at a moment of their choosing. In an attempt to beat that, he then makes this official trip to Japan, where he has dual citizenship, and faxes in his resignation from there. The Peruvians try to extradite them. The Japanese refuse, and he is safely there for 5 years. Then I'm getting ahead of my story a little bit. The crisis in Peru was almost but not quite over. I had gotten a heads up of his intention to resign the day before a Sunday, the head of the council of cabinet members called me and said, Fujimori's just called. He's going to do this. He's not coming back. And we talked about this for a moment, and I said, okay, so what happens next? And he said, well, you know, as you know, the first vice president, Peru has two vice presidents, a first and second. The first vice president had resigned just about 10 days before. And so I assume the second vice president, the next in line of constitutional succession, will become president. And that filled me with alarm because I knew that this fellow was very much a Montesinos man. And so I suddenly saw this is the means by which Montesinos will come back and exercise influence, and everything that we gained could have gone down, have been lost. And sticking my neck out and taking an unconstitutional position, I said, you know, that's not just not going to wash. The opposition will never accept it. I really think the second vice president ought to resign, and you need to go ahead and organize a smooth transition to the next in line of succession, who was the new president of the Congress. That 3 days later is what happened, but not before we went through a bit more nail biting, and all in the context of a previously scheduled high level visit from Washington. So this transition government, it came in. It performed very credibly. Former Secretary General of the United Nations, Javier Pérez de Cuellar, was the prime minister, and they did a good job holding new elections that both Jimmy Carter and Madeleine Albright observed, and that elected the person who had been the primary political opposition leader in the 2000 elections, and then he served out a five-year term. So that is essentially the story, the two epilogues. I started telling the first part of it with respect to Fujimori. He stayed in Japan for 5 years, and then in a monumental miscalculation, he flew to Chile, from where he was hoping to negotiate an amnesty that would permit him to come back and run again in the 2006 elections. He, in fact, still had hard rock core support, somewhere around 33-34% of the Peruvian electorate. And but the Chileans arrested him, put him under house arrest, and he was eventually extradited, and he's now undergoing multiple trials on various charges, most of them on human rights grounds. Montesinos, as it turned out, had fled in a yacht to the Galapagos Islands, and from the Galapagos to Central America, and Central America to Venezuela, where he was protected by retired Venezuelan military intelligence. This is another whole story, but I'll reduce it to a sentence or two. We were under great pressure from everybody in Peru to find Montesinos for them. Surely, with all of your resources, you can find him if you want to. And in fact, we were trying hard. And it was the FBI who located him. When he started running out of money in Venezuela, he tried to get some out of a bank where he had hidden in Miami, where he had hidden other millions. And he sent someone up, the guy in charge of his security, who made the mistake of engaging in some distortion. And the FBI grabbed this guy and got the whole story of where Montesinos was. This guy, in exchange for his not being pressed with charges, agreed to turn Montesinos over to the Peruvians at the Peruvian embassy in Caracas. And they were on their way to deliver him there, got cold feet, decided, uh-oh, we're going to be in trouble with Chavez, and they never took him there. The next morning, and when we had still not figured out, well, what happened, where is Montesinos, there is Hugo Chavez on TV saying, we've captured the most wanted criminal in the Americas. And so the Venezuelans turned Montesinos over to the Peruvians. They flew up and got him. It was the FBI and our investigation that forced their hand. But so now Montesinos has been, he's undergone two or three trials already, has at least a 15-year sentence. He's facing more. That's the end of the story. And let me just say, as you know, I look back on this, I think on the whole, we did a reasonably good job of handling the crisis. There was good coordination on the positive side between my staff and myself on the one hand and Washington on the other, and that's always key to keeping policy coherent. Another key thing that an embassy has to do is keep Washington informed of very fast-breaking developments, and my staff had done an outstanding job there. And we took advantage of this crisis to advance some long-term policy objectives that had gotten stuck with the flawed elections, which was to get Peru back on a democratic track and to disencumber ourselves from this unsavory relationship with Montesinos that we had had. On the other hand, we got out of step with the Peruvian opposition and the human rights community in Peru. These are important constituencies, and it was frankly disturbing that happened. And I also think we could have done a better job of keeping particularly the U.S. press briefed as this crisis went along. In a situation like that, if the press, in your view, gets the story wrong, you end up spending more time trying to get it right, and you have less time to deal with the crisis itself. So it's very important to work with the press as something like that goes forward. And I had inadvertently given them a fundamentally incorrect briefing, and I never quite caught up. Still, all in all, and as we say in government, for government work, it wasn't half bad. So I'll get your reactions and questions. And let me say that over in Fairbanks, I was talking about the outlook for U.S.-Latin American relations under the Obama administration. So if you want to go in that direction with your questions, that's fair.
You've been listening to Alaska World Affairs Council Presents John Hamilton, former ambassador to Guatemala and Peru. Recorded on Friday, February 13th, he spoke on what embassies do in a crisis, the collapse of the Fujimori regime in Peru. Following his talk, he responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked, do you have any thoughts on Hugo Chavez and his future in Venezuela with the price of oil at $40 per barrel?
Well, I think he's in serious economic difficulty. His government, like governments everywhere, adjusts spending more easily upward when revenues are flush than they do downward. And so he's suddenly economically constrained, and already the huge deficits they're running are producing inflation that's the highest in Latin America. They admit to 30%, it's probably higher. Now, inflation, as you know, is just a tax on the poor because wealthier people in systems, economic systems that prevail in Latin America typically find defenses against it. Poor people don't. And so this is hitting him and his core constituency with poor people, and I think his government is in trouble. Still, I would judge at this point it has majority support. We'll get one indication on Sunday. There's yet another vote on whether to lift the two-term limit in Venezuela. And he could well win that vote because he's managed to characterize it as a sort of a yes or no, do you approve of Chavez? And, you know, I think he still has majority support in Venezuela. So, but I think over the next year and a half, it's going to be hard to maintain that support with the economic downturn and the hardship that poor people in particular are going to be having.
Another audience member stated her belief in the peaceful coexistence between all countries and non-interference in the affairs of sovereign nations. She wanted to know why Fujimori was such a bad guy and why the United States felt the need to intervene in Peru.
Well, you know, I get that question a lot. And in telling the story, you know, I kind of brace myself when I tell about particularly the position I took right at the very end. And non-intervention is sort of one of the cardinal principles of Latin American politics and diplomacy, non-intervention from the U.S. But what you find, of course, is that nobody wants you to stand aloof. They just all want you to help them. And the opposition always had a fairly compelling argument in saying, you keep your hands off of this situation. That's, in effect, support for Fujimori because he has all the resources and power of government, and he's using it to the hilt. And that was, in fact, true. As I said, they had bought off the judiciary, the press, the elections commission, and they had done this through means that were not, small d democratic politics. And they didn't, ultimately they had stolen money, and they had used the power of the state. They had had people, they're being tried for that now, for some massacres that took place. So I think that's the best short answer I can give you.
Did the United States' involvement in the collapse of the Fujimori regime result in the U.S. being perceived as an ally to Peru, or did it have the opposite effect? And what is the status of how the United States is perceived in Peru today?
I think it was mixed. I think a lot of people on balance thought that we had played a positive role. But I'm not sure that we ever repaired our relationship with the sort of the full-time human rights advocates for whom putting Montesinos in jail was a top priority. And I swear to you, the version I've given you of it was the U.S. that in effect caught and had Montesinos returned. Still, it was the Venezuelans and Chavez who handed him over, and we were always playing catch-up to get the true story across. Everything that we had been doing to, and particularly once we had Montesinos located, we were working with the Minister of Interior, and at his request we had not briefed the rest of his government to keep the knowledge of what was going on contained. He had repeatedly assured me that he was keeping the President informed, but after we called Montesinos, I realized from the first statements the President made that he had no clue of the positive role that we had played. And frankly, I was more than annoyed and worked out with the FBI for them to do a briefing in Miami, which they did, and they got their full story on the record, and then I worked off that. And the Peruvian government then gave everybody in the U.S. Embassy that had worked this issue awards, but they gave them to us in a ceremony to which the Peruvian press was not invited. So,
in dealing with the Middle East, we're hearing a lot of discussion today about the relative power of the State Department, the CIA, and military intelligence, with President Obama and Hillary Clinton talking about increasing the size of the State Department. In that context, what was your experience in relations with military intelligence and CIA? Who was the lead? An audience member asked.
Well, I couldn't have had a better situation. They were very professional, disciplined people in both services. They worked hand in glove with me. They took direction from me. They couldn't have been better. And I think that's the way it is in most places of the world. You know, the situation really that has arisen that you premise your question on just has to go with the massive U.S. military presence we have. And with the size of the job and the resources that the U.S. military have that just dwarf any amount of personnel or financial resources that the State Department, which is the smallest of the cabinet departments. There are more people in U.S. military bands than there are in the State Department. This is true. This is literally the case. And so when Obama and Secretary Clinton say, what we really want to do is beef up our civilian and diplomatic capabilities, I just say, thank the Lord. And it is just a wonderful, wonderful news. I hope they're going to have the resources to do it.
Last, an audience member asked, how has the United States' relations with Central and South America changed over the last 8 years? The power of the United States has clearly diminished in Chile and Guatemala, has it not?
Well, we are still paying a price for what happened in 1954. I certainly got asked about that. President Clinton, when he went to Guatemala before I got there, apologized essentially for that, which helped a lot, actually. And by the time I got there, I think we had the best relationship with the hardcore left in Guatemala than we had had in history. Now, I think that the state of our relationship with Latin America is, in fact, better than you would be tempted to conclude if you took the state of our relationship with Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and Ecuador as indicative of the state of the relationship with the region as a whole. And or if you were, you know, to read the New York Times, which is basically run the same article at least a dozen times about how Latin America has turned left and anti-U.S. in the last 8 or 10 years. Because that's the extent to which the major countries have truly turned to leftist approaches to governance and management of their economies is greatly overstated. And in fact, one of the best relationships we had was between President Bush and President Lula of Brazil. Those guys hit it off. We've always had a test. Our relationship with Brazil has been much like our relationship with India. It's always been just had this undercurrent of testiness to it. It's the best in the last 8 years that it's ever been. Bush went there in 2007. We got an agreement on biofuels. We set aside our trade differences, concentrated on the positive. You know, under Bush, we consolidated the Summit of the Americas process that began under Clinton, was continued under Bush, and Obama is going to continue it. The first big meeting with Latin America that Obama will be in Trinidad and Tobago April 17th. Watch for the news of that event. We had new debt reduction initiatives that were more generous in reducing Latin American debt. We went ahead with free trade when the Brazilians didn't want to do it on a hemispheric level on bilateral agreements. We now have free trade agreements working up the west coast of South America, Chile, Peru, Colombia, Panama, Central America, the Dominican Republic, Mexico, and Canada. It goes from Chile to Alaska. And only the Panamanian and Colombian agreements haven't been ratified by the Congress yet. Another indicator of where this administration will go in hemispheric relations has to do with trade. And that, you know, we'll have to see what role trade has in an overall economic recovery approach, and then particularly how he handles these two outstanding trade agreements. So that's another big issue. But he inherits a situation that at least, you know, doesn't have anything equivalent to an Iraq, you know, that's poisoned relations with the whole hemisphere. There's no equivalent power to Russia, you know, nuclear-armed, resentful of recent humiliations, nationalistic and prickly. There's no power like China that is threatening to clean our clocks on in the economic sphere. There are new initiatives. The so-called Merida for Merida, Mexico, where it was launched to help the Central Americans and Mexicans on their tremendous problems with organized crime. And then there's another very interesting initiative called the Pathways to Prosperity Initiative. And this was launched just last August. I hope that the Obama folks will take it up. And the idea is to look at, with our trading free trade partners in the hemisphere, to think seriously together what we can do to implement these agreements in a way that spread their benefits more broadly and particularly help poor sectors. And inequality is still greater in Latin America than any other developing region of the world. And I think this is one way that the tone of the relationship could be changed if we can give this effort a higher profile and really put our best minds to work on it.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents John Hamilton, former ambassador to Peru and Guatemala. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk on what embassies do in a crisis, the collapse of the Fujimori regime in Peru. John Hamilton was recorded speaking at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska on Friday, February 13th, 2009. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.